It's 10:06. Frederick Law Olmsted, probably not a name that comes instantly to mind when you think of places like Central Park or the grounds of our nation's Capitol building. You may not even realize that he was one of the most influential people of the 19th century. But if you had read Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, you certainly would know these things. In his new biography of this troubled genius, author Justin Martin paints a fascinating portrait of a man who overcame much, accomplished much, and suffered much. This hour, we're going to find out more about him. Justin Martin is a journalist and author. His other books include Greenspan, The Man Behind Money, and Nader, Crusader, Spoiler, Icon. He joins me by phone. Justin Martin, good morning and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How did you first become aware of Frederick Olmsted?
Well, in my case, as a New Yorker, I sort of slowly, Central Park was sort of my common yard, as it is for so many New Yorkers, and I sort of slowly began to learn more and more about the man behind it. And then I had a friend who became a Central Park tour guide, so that began to deepen my appreciation. And then I moved to a neighborhood in New York City called Forest Hills Gardens, which was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. At that point, I felt like I started to learn much more about Olmsted, and I also felt sort of like my next biography subject was kind of staring me in the face.
So that's what led you to, yes, this is the biography to write, and now is the time to write it.
Very much, because as I learned more about him, I recognized, as you suggested at the outset, that he was somebody who's an extremely important American historical figure from the 19th century, and yet not so well known necessarily for his park work, and then beyond that, not well known at all for some of the other things he did. So I started to learn more that he was this sort of underappreciated historical figure, and I also thought, given some of the things that he was involved in, such as abolition and environmentalism, those are things that are very, very much on people's minds today. So I thought that made him an interesting figure to explore.
Well, I guess reading this, I was somewhat surprised that we don't know more about him, that his name isn't more commonly known, because given the things that he accomplished in his lifetime, you would think that his public footprint, if you will, would be a bit larger. Why is it that we don't know a lot about him and that we aren't that familiar with his work, unless we happen to be really into landscape architecture?
I think there are two really great reasons. First of all, the artworks he created, his beautiful park creations, are just places people enjoy. I mean, unlike if you went to a museum and saw a painting, if you heard a piece of music, you'd want to know immediately who is the artist behind this. People can enjoy Olmsted's parks, and there's really no demand that they know who this park maker is. And so you have this situation repeated all over the country, whether it be Central Park or the Emerald Necklace in Boston or the parks in Rochester, New York, and on down the line, where people really appreciate and enjoy these parks. But as I said, it's not necessary to find out who's behind them. The second reason I think that Olmsted isn't as well known as he deserves to be is because he's an example of someone who did several things very well. And often people like to sort of boil someone down to one historical exclamation point. And a good example is if someone becomes president of the United States, that's something you will always remember them for, no matter what they were before that. In Olmsted's case, he did several things extraordinarily well, but it's hard to boil him down to one thing. And because of that, I think that he's not as well known as he deserves to be.
Yeah, I was just looking at there are some photographs in the book and that illustrate some of the things that Olmsted did and some of his family relationships and so forth. But I was interested to note that among the things that he designed was he designed the grounds for the Biltmore Estate near Asheville, North Carolina. Of course, it's a very famous piece of American architecture, and I've seen documentaries on it, but I didn't see any reference to the person who designed the grounds. We tend to focus on the building.
He designed the grounds. It was a monumental project with long, far-reaching ramifications, because what happened was the Biltmore Estate, as you described, is this giant house. It's the largest house in the United States, and it's a gigantic house designed by an architect named Richard Morris Hunt. But the surrounding grounds were designed by Olmsted. And Olmsted, of course, right around the Biltmore Estate, he designed gardens, as you might imagine. But for hundreds of thousands of acres beyond that, Olmsted suggested planting a managed forest. And this was a really innovative idea. And the client in this case, George Vanderbilt, then the wealthiest man in America, agreed to Olmsted's suggestion. Olmsted said, let's take hundreds of thousands of acres around the Biltmore Estate and turn it into an experiment in managed forestry. This was at a time when America kind of had a myth of the primeval, limitless forest. And so the idea of actually having a managed forest was very unique, and Vanderbilt caught into the idea. Olmsted then helped identify the person who would help manage this vast forest land, and he suggested Gifford Pinchot. And the land surrounding the Biltmore Estate came to be known as the cradle of forestry in the United States. Gifford Pinchot was then tapped by Teddy Roosevelt to head up the U.S. Forest Service, and ultimately that big piece of land surrounding the Biltmore Estate, some of it is still intact, but some of it was sold to the U.S. government after George Vanderbilt's death to the Pisgah National Forest, which is the largest national forest east of the Mississippi River. So that's a good example of a place where Olmsted just had a monumental impact in U.S. history.
What was it that that set Olmsted on the path of becoming a landscape architect? I mean, did he wake up one day and said, this is what I want to do with my life, or how did that transpire?
For Olmsted, what it really was a deep passion for landscape, and it was rooted really in his very earliest experiences. His father would put him on the pillow. Olmsted grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. His father would put him on the on a pillow sitting in front of the saddle of a horse, and his father would ride out into the countryside around Hartford, and little Fred would be sitting on the pillow. And his father was not a bookish man, not someone given to any kind of formal learning, but his father would proceed on what he described as loitering journeys, where he just viewed nature with a kind of hushed reverence, and this made a huge impression on little Fred. And as Fred grew older, he did all kinds of things, like being a surveyor and so forth, that really gave him an appreciation for landscape. But then ultimately becoming a landscape architect was very much by accident. Furthermore, should we point out that landscape architect didn't really even exist as a known profession in the United States, at least. So Olmsted, with an early passion for landscape, accidentally became a landscape architect and really pioneered the profession in the United States.
He did not have a lot of formal education, did he?
He didn't. He was schooled by a series of poor country parsons who were so busy with their parsonage duties that they couldn't even pay attention to Olmsted. He was very mischievous, and he'd sneak out into the countryside, set traps for quail, and go hunting and fishing. And again, he learned a lot about landscape, learned a real appreciation for landscape, didn't get a lot of formal schooling.
And what effect did that have on him professionally and in his later life? Did that become a problem for him?
It didn't really. The interesting thing with Olmsted is he did so many different things. He was a surveyor, a farmer, a sailor, and an extraordinarily accomplished journalist. He would be remembered as a historical footnote, at least for his journalism work, had he not gone on to be a landscape architect. When he became a landscape architect, the best way to describe it almost is it was almost as if his earlier life experiences had given him a classic liberal arts education, not a formal one, but he'd been exposed to so many different disciplines, with all the different things he tried, that when he pioneered landscape architecture, he brought all these different insights from all these different endeavors that he tried out in his life. And so he really, I think that landscape architecture, and I think Olmsted's own designs, whether it be the Capitol grounds in Washington, D.C., or the Emerald Necklace in Boston, or what have you, really benefited from this kind of multidisciplinary approach that he brought to these projects.
Let's talk about Olmsted the journalist a little bit. I guess I'm trying to draw the connection here, maybe connect the dots. Here's someone who grew up, didn't have a lot of formal education, and yet became, as you say, a very accomplished journalist. There's that seems to be a little bit of a non sequitur.
Yeah, I suppose it is a non sequitur. I mean, I guess there are a couple things to consider. First of all, though he didn't gain a formal education, he was an avid reader, and so he was very well read. He also was somebody who was a real opportunist. He seized opportunities when they came his way. And there was a brand new newspaper called the New York Times, circa the 1850s. And it was, like any startup, it was looking for talent and looking for and trying to sort of stake its position in the competitive field. And so the New York Times, on the basis of a 5-minute interview, was willing to hire Olmsted for an absolutely dream gig. He was hired to travel across the South at a time of ratcheting tensions between the North and South. This was the early 1850s, and report on the South almost as if he was a foreign correspondent. He was handed this gig because he was well-read, even though he wasn't formally trained. He also, strangely enough, part of the reason he was handed this dream job to travel to the South, dream reporting job, was because he'd been lately working as a farmer. And the South in that era was nothing if not an agrarian society. And so it made sense to send Olmsted, who was so familiar with farming practices, down to cover the antebellum South. And the only way to describe it is, I'm sure when the editor, Henry Raymond, hired Olmsted, he had expectations, but nothing could have prepared anyone for what a talented reporter Olmsted turned out to be. He went everywhere. He talked to everyone. He talked to plantation owners. He talked to slaves. He talked to poor white farmers. And he produced a spectacular series of dispatches that literally helped put the brand new New York Times on the map.
What was his philosophy about slavery at that time? Was he already an abolitionist, or was it this trip through the South that that generated this feeling?
Very much the latter. Part of I mentioned a couple of Olmsted's qualifications that were teased out in this 5-minute interview with the editor, Henry Raymond. Another thing that Raymond was very keen on doing was he wanted to send a reporter to the South who is not a diehard abolitionist. He wanted someone to go down there and really have something of an open mind. And Olmsted was what was known as a gradualist. And gradualism was a very common stance in America in the 19th century and even before that. I mean, Thomas Jefferson probably could properly be called a gradualist. Gradualists believe slavery is wrong, but they recognize that it was a very thorny economic institution that was going to take a lot of time to kind of unwind. And so Olmsted was a gradualist when he set out for the South, and so that made him properly open-minded from the New York Times conception of things. And, you know, he really, Olmsted believed, at least at the outset, that slavery was something that needed to be unwound in due time. But when he traveled to the South, based on everything he witnessed, he grew to be a fervent abolitionist. And the very fact that his Southern dispatches show him making this transition helped make them very convincing, very powerful documents. If he'd simply headed down South and just viewed slave owners as evil from the outset and so forth, that probably wouldn't have been as effective as these series of 48 dispatches in which you see Olmsted himself make a transition from gradualist to really a red-hot abolitionist.
So he became a rabid abolitionist. How did that manifest itself in his life? What did he do on behalf of this new belief?
One of the main things he did was he actually helped out. He helped out the struggles in Bloody Kansas in the 1850s are really kind of a precursor to the Civil War. They were really the first shots fired. Even before Sumter, you had violence between Kansas and Missouri, between people who thought that the territory of Kansas should become a slave state, people who thought the territory of Kansas should become a free state. So Olmsted actually helped support the Kansas Free State Militia, and he actually raised money from some of his fellow New York abolitionists, such as Horace Greeley, the man who actually coined the term Bleeding Kansas. He raised money, and then he purchased a cannon, and then he arranged for the cannon to be broken apart into pieces and shipped because it was dangerous. It would, you know, if it was detected that the ship was being, or rather that this cannon was being shipped to free soilers in Kansas, it could get Olmsted in trouble or it could get the free soilers in some kind of trouble. So Olmsted broke the cannon into a variety of different pieces, shipped it to Lawrence, Kansas. It was reassembled and sat in front of the Lawrence Free State Hotel for the Bloody Kansas struggle. So that's one example of how he very much became an abolitionist and was in support of the cause.
We're talking about the life of Frederick Law Olmsted. There's a new biography just published, written by Justin Martin, who's my guest this hour. The book is titled Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, Abolitionist, Conservationist, and Designer of Central Park. Wondering if you have questions about this man. We have the author of the biography here to answer them. You can reach us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. There's also a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can leave a comment there, and we already have one, which I will share in just a moment. First, though, we're going to take a quick break. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. 22 minutes after 10 o'clock. Later on today on the Ideas Network, many, many problems face American cities, from crumbling infrastructure to underemployment. As cities try new ways to meet these challenges, their solutions can offer all of us different ways to plan for the future. After one on Talk of the Nation, American Cities in the 21st Century, New York Mayor Cory Booker is among the guests. That's later today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the life and the work of Frederick Law Olmsted. There's a new biography out titled Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, Abolitionist, Conservationist, and Designer of Central Park, written by Justin Martin, who is a journalist and has written several other books, including Greenspan, The Man Behind Money, and Nader, Crusader, Spoiler, Icon. Again, if you'd like to join us, still a line open for you at 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. You can leave a message for us on Facebook. There is a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, which Nathaniel has left a comment on. And he says, as your guest may already know, Olmsted was involved in parks here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So there is more than one Wisconsin connection to this man. Well, thanks for your comment, Nathaniel. Justin Martin, Olmsted designed parks all over the country.
Yes, he did. And the person who wrote in the Facebook, they rightly point out that he designed a whole system of parks. That was one of Olmsted's hallowed concepts, was to design an entire system of parks, which was a brilliant idea that he innovated. And it allowed you, instead of having a single park like Central Park, you could have all kinds of different topography. If you had several different parks in different parts of the city, you could have all different kinds of topography. You could also have all kinds of different features. Maybe one park would be on a riverfront, another park could be on a lakefront, another park could be inland. You could have different, you could divide the parks up where they would have different features. One could maybe be for sort of passive recreation, contemplation of nature. Another could be for active recreation. Brilliant Olmsted concept, realized beautifully in Milwaukee, where I've recently visited to see the parks. And one other element of the Olmsted park system was Olmsted is a Democrat, as a reformer, as someone who always wanted to enact social reform. He rightly recognized that if you had several different parks in the city, as he designed for Milwaukee, that as the city grew up around the parks, all different neighborhoods, all different kinds of neighborhoods would be served by the parks, and all different kinds of people would mix and mingle, fulfilling a kind of democratic vision that he had.
What do you think Olmsted would think of the way cities have developed since his lifetime?
Well, I think he would be, you know, as somebody who had very much a naturalistic aesthetic, and there's a famous Thomas Jefferson saying, cities are great sewers, and Olmsted very much subscribed to that. He subscribed to a very 19th century and before idea that the countryside was the place that one could go for rest, rehabilitation, spiritual replenishment. And so he was exposed to a different kind of city. He was exposed to an era when cities had teeming slums and, you know, tight pack industry and so forth. And so he didn't tend to view cities as such great cultural engines as they turned out to be. So I don't think he had the greatest appreciation for cities. I think if he saw the way cities had developed now, I'm not sure he'd be able to understand it very well. I think he'd probably focus in very much on, you know, the choked pollution, the heavy traffic and so forth. I don't think he'd necessarily be able to appreciate some of the cultural, you know, museums and things that were also there. He was somebody who very much was in the view, the antidote to crowded city life were parks, and you know, he was very much of a 19th century mindset in that fashion.
Did he have to sell these park ideas very hard? I mean, real estate is expensive, and they aren't making any more of it. Was there resistance to the ideas that he had of establishing parks in cities?
In every case, almost every case, up, down, and sideways, he found all of his, these were very challenging enterprises for him. He was very much an artist. He would brook no compromise. He had vivid visions for what he wanted to do in these various cities. And as you might imagine, these parks were, overseen by park commissions, and so Olmsted had to battle with park commissions. He had there are people, and you know, these are big democratic cities where people would, you know, where there would be a babble of voices weighing in, people wanting different things. And Olmsted was a very single-minded visionary artist who would battle. He had all kinds of he would write his park reports, trying to argue his case, and then sometimes, you know, certain elements of his parks were if there was some call not to develop something he suggested or to overturn something, he would sometimes help them as a journalist. He'd actually sometimes go to the public. He would announce a town hall meeting and argue his case and hope that some of his journalistic brethren would write articles that were supportive of his park vision. So these were all these parks are compromises. Olmsted didn't like to compromise one degree, but all of them were, you know, compromises to some degree because he had to agree to what the park commissions and the public wanted, and all of them were hard-fought battles.
Okay. We have some callers who want to join us, and let's start in Milwaukee with George. George,
hi.
Good morning.
I wanted to put a plug in for the Frederick Law Olmsted National Historic Site, which is immediately right outside of Boston and Brookline. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that it's one of the most inspiring historic sites that I've ever visited. And I know that they're doing a little renovation right now on it, but it's supposed to, I guess, be reopened fully within a few months. But I would very much encourage visitors to the Boston area to check it out, because they've basically kind of reconstructed the old Olmsted architecture offices from around the 1920s. Now, Olmsted was already gone by then, but his son continued on, and it's just an absolutely fascinating place.
I totally agree. It's a great place to visit. I mean, it's of historical interest. The offices inside of the house, and then the grounds surrounding the house are well worth seeing, because it's Olmsted, as you might imagine, when he actually moved to the suburbs, to Brookline, because it's a classic thing. He didn't want to live in a city anymore. He wanted to have a yard, and boy, did he ever have a yard. He used his great landscaping skill to kind of create a personal park surrounding the house. So it's a great house to visit inside, and also a great house to walk the grounds of.
George, thanks for that phone call. Let's go next to Jack, who is calling from Superior. Jack, good morning.
Yes, it's hard to hear you, but my question is somewhat on the last person saying that his son carried on his work. I was wondering whether his extended family carried on his work, grandchildren. I was familiar with the Charles Olmsted at the Department of Botany, University mm-hmm. of Chicago, not too many years back, and wondering if it's the same family. Charles Olmsted, any of the grandchildren who carried on his work? And
That's a really good question. His son, his natural son, Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., and his stepson, his eldest stepson, John Charles Olmsted, carried on the landscape architecture practice. They carried it all the way to 1858. And so Olmsted did Central Park, his first project, in 1858, and his sons carried the business on to 1958, so a century worth of work there between Olmsted and his sons. However, I don't know, at that point, no other Olmsteds were involved directly in landscape architecture in the business. There are a lot of Olmsteds around the country, and many of them are probably related to Olmsted distantly or in some fashion, and the person you referred to, perhaps they're a distant relative of some kind, but the real connection was Olmsted ran a landscape architecture, a pioneering landscape architecture outfit until late in his life, and then his sons took over, carried it on through the 20th century until 1958, they got a lot of work done all over the country, but that's sort of the Olmsted legacy.
Jack, thanks for the call and for the question. Room for you to get in if you'd like to ask your own question or make a comment. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, and of course the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook fan page, where you can leave a comment, as Julie from Milwaukee has done. She says, "We got married last summer in Lake Park and Olmsted Park, and just bought a house on Newbury Boulevard, which was the boulevard was designed by Olmsted." So more about Olmsted's work in the city of Milwaukee.
Beautiful. Would you like me to comment briefly on Julie's?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's Lake Park. I was married in Central Park. Olmsted Parks are beautiful places to be married in, and Lake Park is just a gorgeous park. And then Newbury Boulevard that she referred to is actually part of Olmsted's brilliant conception for a park system. Was how do you connect a park system, parkways. It was a concept he came up with and also a term he came up with. He came up with the term parkway, which, of course, is a much-abused term today. You get on any road that has a little bit of green space in the middle, they call it a parkway. But Newbury was to be one of the parkways, and it, in fact, connects, if I remember correctly, it connects Lake Park with Riverside Park. But as often happened with Olmsted's projects, not all the parkways, not all the connecting roads between the parks ever got built. And so there's no connection, I think, between Riverside Park and Washington Park, the other Olmsted park. But in Olmsted's conception, he loved this idea of you've got several distinct parks, and then you've got these landscaped, tree-lined parkways that connect the parks, and you can travel from park to park, never leaving green space. So Newbury Boulevard in Milwaukee represents one of those parkways that Olmsted conceived of.
Well, Julie, appreciate the comment. We are getting some more phone calls, and while we get those lined up, a couple other questions. One of the things that, as I was looking at this biography, that was fascinating about Olmsted was his own family life. He was very, very close to his brother John, wasn't he?
He sure was. Yeah, his brother John, in a way, I guess you could almost say John was his best friend. So his mother died when he was very little. Olmsted's mother did, and the only children born to his mother were John and Frederick Law Olmsted. Then his father remarried and had four other children who lived to maturity. And those other children, Olmsted didn't feel, he treated them almost like cousins. They treated him almost like a cousin. And also the mother-in-law, Olmsted never had a good relationship with her. So he and John were kind of bonded as the two children born to his mother, and then there was a stepmother in the picture and the other children. So it created a complicated family dynamic and made Olmsted and John very close.
And his brother died at age 32. Talk about how that affected Olmsted.
It affected Olmsted deeply. His brother died of tuberculosis, and Olmsted really, at that point, Olmsted was just getting started on his first great masterpiece, Central Park, and it changed. The death of Olmsted's brother changed him. He was, as a young person, as a younger man, Olmsted had been very kind of enthusiastic and scattershot. When his brother died, Olmsted threw himself into work, and he learned a pattern that he would repeat throughout the rest of his life. He learned to cope with tragedy by throwing himself into work, and he became also a more focused, less exuberant, but also he got a lot more done in the aftermath of that. But John's death certainly affected him in that way. Second fascinating way in which John's death affected him was John wrote a deathbed letter to Fred, his brother, in which he said, "Don't let Mary suffer while you are alive." That was a reference to Mary, John's wife, and soon to be his widow. Well, a couple years hence, Olmsted actually married his brother's widow, and raised three of his brother's sons with Mary. Adopted them and raised them as his own son. So it shows a lot of complicated interfamilial dynamics.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And then he and Mary had their own children then, too, correct?
That's correct. They had children of their own, and that created yet more complicated dynamics because one of those children was Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. One of his brother John's children was John Charles. And so those were the two children that took on the Olmsted firm that would succeed Olmsted. And, of course, it was a very complicated relationship because you have a stepson and a natural son who has been named Frederick Law Olmsted Jr., both, sort of working in this firm but also competing to be the proper inheritor of their father's vision. So it's yet more complex interfamilial dynamics at play there.
Well, Olmsted had a number of tragedies in his life. He lost his brother, who was, as you said, was his best friend at a fairly young age, although perhaps for the 19th century that wasn't as young an age as we would think of it today. But he had a lot of other tragedy in his life.
You sure did. No, Olmsted lost one of those stepchildren that he was raising for his brother. He lost one of his natural children in a terrible carriage accident. That same carriage accident shattered Olmsted's thigh in three places and actually caused his left leg to be 2 inches shorter than his right leg, and he walked with a limp for the rest of his life. he had a number of close friends who succumbed early to various diseases and accidents. So Olmsted's life was, we tend to think of the past as being a time when tragedy was more ever-present, and Olmsted had more than his share of tragedy by 19th-century standards.
All right, we have, the phone lines are suddenly full. Let's take some calls. Here's Barbara in Eau Claire. You'll be next. Barbara, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, can you hear me? Barbara.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, by Delaware Park, and in later years it's been changed to Olmsted Park. Mm-hmm. It's a gorgeous place. I played tennis there for 6 years, and it's where the Pan American, I grew up on the street where the Pan American Exposition was held, very close to the park. And as a result, two gorgeous buildings remain, the Buffalo Historical Society mm-hmm. and the Albright Knox Art Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, did Olmsted design Delaware Park before Central Park? I had heard that.
No, that's not true. It was
okay.
he started working on Central Park in 1857 and actually started working on design in 1858. It was 10 years later, 1868, that he started working on the Buffalo Park system. And when I was describing the park system in Milwaukee, the Buffalo Park system, when he worked on the Buffalo Park system, he was then teamed up with Calvert Vaux, and this was really the very first effort at doing this brilliant idea of the park system. And Buffalo has Delaware Park, and the other parks are just, it has a beautiful system there. So, it was 10 years after Central Park that he started working on the Buffalo Parks.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, surely. Thank you.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Let's go to Ironwood, Michigan next and hear what Nancy has to say. Nancy, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Nancy.
My story, I don't know if the biographer's ever heard it before, but in Marquette, Michigan, they have a beautiful little place called Presque Isle.
I was there
it's
about 2 months
actually,
ago.
Actually, pretty much an island, just has one little part that's adjoining to the land. And they invited Mr. Olmsted out to look at the park and decide what to do with it, the city fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out, as the story goes, by the tour operators, and he rode around the park, and he looked at it, and he came back, and he said, leave it just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what they've done.
It sure is. I'll tell you, it's funny. Olmsted, as he got on in his career, he started to wear two hats, and one hat was park maker. And being a park maker often required a huge amount of intervention. It required, to give an example, it required more gunpowder than was used at the Battle of Gettysburg to create Central Park. It looks naturalistic, but it involved all kinds of demolition and explosions. As he got on his career, he started to wear a second hat, which was environmentalist. He became a person who really advocated for wild spaces that to be preserved, places like Yosemite and Niagara Falls. He was really the key 19th century figure behind the preservation of these wild spaces. When he went to Marquette, as you described, They were fully prepared to give him a commission to design a park, the city elders in Marquette, Michigan. But Olmsted put on his environmentalist hat, shot his own commission in the foot, basically, and said, hey, this is such a beautiful piece of land. Let's not turn it into a park. Let's just leave it as is. And Olmsted wrote this very passionate letter in which he described what a beautiful place Presque Isle is near Marquette, Michigan, the park that we're referring to, or the wild space we're referring to. And that letter is so eloquent that to this day, if anybody even dreamed of putting anything on Presque Isle, they'd just whip out this 19th century Olmsted letter, and that person would be silenced. So it's a beautiful place, Presque Isle, and thanks for your question.
Well, and we owe him a lot because he left it, and it's beautiful. And like you said, he could have made money on it
mm-hmm.
for his own needs and things, and instead he left it for all the people, and people enjoy it immensely.
Yeah, no, it is. It was really nice that he did that, and you're absolutely right. If he could have made some money and made it a more designful space, but he rightly recognized it was really a unique, beautiful spot right on Lake Superior.
Right, and the kids enjoy jumping off the rocks there and picnics and everything, so it's well used. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. Marquette, Michigan, I've been there many times, had an aunt and uncle there, and it's where I learned that it's not a good idea to jump into Lake Superior in early June. Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. Sherry in Mazomanie. Sherry, good morning.
Hi. I was raised on the west side of Madison, and there is a wonderful park there called Hoyt Park that was designed by Frederick Law's Olmsted, and it preceded Central Park. It's an easy-to-get-to park, a easy one to walk around in, and people should know about it.
Well, interesting. That's I'll tell you, it couldn't have preceded Central Park because you know, that was Olmsted's, literally his very first project in 1860.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah,
well, I wonder how they had the money to hire him to do it then. But anyway, we got a park here in Madison, and it's on the near west side, off from Owen Drive.
Oh, very good. I hope next time in Madison, I'll be sure to check out Hoyt Park, you said.
Very good. Thank you. Bye.
Shirley.
Thanks for the call, Sherry. We had a caller earlier who wanted you to comment on Devil in the White City.
Sure. Devil in the White City, great book, and Olmsted looms large in that book, because that book is about, it's interrelated stories, as people might know, about a murder that's interrelated with the Chicago World's Fair. And the Chicago World's Fair was this grand scale, you know, chance or opportunity for Chicago and then America to really make a showing on the world stage, just as when World Fairs were a big deal. And Olmsted was to design the landscape for the Chicago World's Fair, and he came up with just a spectacular and innovative landscape design. And this was a good example of where Olmsted did a lot of battling. His design was very innovative, very unusual, and it forced him to go to battle with everybody from Daniel Burnham, who was the dynamic director of the fair, to Teddy Roosevelt, who wanted to place his, what was called the Boone and Crockett Club. He wanted to place it on Olmsted's landscape. And Olmsted wanted this particular piece of landscape to be unhindered, unfettered. And so he told the future president, Teddy Roosevelt, no, and Roosevelt actually backed down in this confrontation. So Olmsted saw through a really innovative landscape that helped make this, you know, a World Fair there just open for a season. So it's really just open for 6 months. And you know, but Olmsted was well aware that if he created a beautiful landscape, that it would stick with people in memory. So it's a great, Devil in the White City is a great book describing the, you know, this particular, among other things, this landscape effort by Olmsted.
And speaking of Teddy Roosevelt, we'll be talking about him next Thursday. There's a new book out about the life of Teddy Roosevelt. We're going to talk about TR. And next Thursday here on the Kathleen Dunn program. So everything's interrelated. We're talking this hour, though, about the life of Frederick Law Olmsted. The book is Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, Abolitionist, Conservationist, and Designer of Central Park, written by Justin Martin. Justin Martin is my guest. And we have time for some more calls. If you'd like to call in, here is the number, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. And as so many people have today, you can almost leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller is in after 11 o'clock, and a new study indicates that eating potatoes can have quite an impact on the waistline. After 11, Larry Mueller's guest helps us navigate our nutrition choices. That's coming up after the news at 11 o'clock. This hour, it's the biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, written by Justin Martin, who has also written a couple of other biographies, including Greenspan, The Man Behind Money, and Nader, Crusader, Spoiler, Icon. Well, Justin Martin, we've got some more callers who want to join us, but before we go back to the phones, talk about Olmsted's work as a writer. What was the Southern Trilogy?
The Southern Trilogy was, after he'd done 48 dispatches for the New York Times, he actually took those and kind of shaped them, added certain connecting material and so forth, and it wound up covering three. He didn't lack for words. He was a verbose guy, so he wound up making three huge trilogies, or a huge trilogy consisting of three huge books based on his Southern travels, and those books were then condensed down to a single volume called The Cotton Kingdom. The Cotton Kingdom is actually, it was published in 1861, and here, 150 years later, it is still in print. So I wouldn't recommend trying. I've actually read all three of the books in the trilogy. Wouldn't recommend it for the faint of heart, but the Cotton Kingdom, which kind of boils it all down, is a great read that, as I said, is still in print.
And Olmsted did some terrific humanitarian work during the Civil War itself.
That's right, yeah, for the Given all that he'd seen during his travels through the South, he certainly was eager to join the Union cause when the Civil War broke out. And I described earlier how he'd broken his thigh in three places, and so he certainly was not. And he was also, by this time when the Civil War broke out, he would have been almost 40, so he was not particularly good soldier material. But he ended up heading up, he went down to Washington, and he ended up heading up a battlefield relief outfit called the United States Sanitary Commission, and it just provided immeasurable relief and help to wounded soldiers during the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, through a whole series of convolutions, the United States Sanitary Commission, the outfit that Olmsted had headed up, wound up sort of morphing into the American Red Cross.
Wow, that's a fascinating piece of information. What surprised you the most as you did the research for this book? What thing that just really jumped out and made you go, whoa?
I think the thing that surprised me the most was really learning that America in this era was a frontier society, not only in terms of space, but also psychologically. And it was just, I think this is what Olmsted really benefited from, was it was just a different time when a frontier society where it was just anything that you showed an interest in perhaps doing or showed even a little bit of acumen, you could get drafted into the service. I mean, you know, here's Olmsted, a well-read farmer, and he can land a gig with the New York Times doing journalism. Here's Olmsted, a park maker, and that's where his administrative abilities extended to. And you can, when the Civil War breaks out, and you can be called upon to head up a battlefield relief outfit, very different from being a park maker. But basically, it was a different era when it was kind of all hands. If something needed to be done, all hands on deck. And so I found, in researching the book, I found that inspiring, and I also found it kind of heartbreaking because we have a different world today where there's a lot more, I think, narrow specialization.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the circumstances toward the end of Olmsted's life. Rather tragic.
Absolutely. I described earlier that the World's Fair and his absolutely incredible design for that. Well, Olmsted, at the very end of his life, he was not sanguine. When he was an old man, he was very almost desperate, full of anxiety, to have a few more masterpieces, the World's Fairgrounds being one of them, because he was very concerned that his park work would be all sort of decimated or rolled back after his death. And his very unsanguine old age really wore him down. And in 1895, he started to show the very first manifestations of what must have been some kind of senile dementia. He became forgetful. He became agitated. Perhaps it was even Alzheimer's disease, but there's no diagnosis in that era. And so Olmsted, he declined very quickly, and he was then confined to a mental institution for which he'd earlier landscaped the grounds. Years earlier, he'd suggested a very elaborate landscape plan for what's called McLean Asylum on the outskirts of Boston, Massachusetts. And when Olmsted was admitted into McLean Asylum, among his last reported words were, "Confound them, they didn't follow my plan."
We have more callers. Let's go to Tony in Mukwonago next. Tony, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Tony. Go ahead.
All right. I wanted to know if there's any connection with Jens Jensen, the naturalist, landscape architect, who was also affiliated at times with Frank Lloyd Wright. That's my question.
Great, great question. There's no real, as far as I know, there's no real relationship between Olmsted and Jens Jensen, but there's a relationship, I guess you could say, of spirit. I mean, Olmsted was the 19th century naturalistic landscape architect, and as you point out, Jens Jensen was a 20th century naturalistic landscape architect, sort of the favored, the court landscape architect of Frank Lloyd Wright. So you have many, many Frank Lloyd Wright homes that are surrounded by Jens Jensen landscape architecture, Jens Jensen plans for the grounds. And so I don't know of any actual meeting between the two men, but they certainly were sort of accomplices in spirit.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Greg in Racine, you'll be next. Greg, good morning.
Hi there. I've enjoyed this conversation a lot. Mr. Martin, I had the pleasure of interviewing you a couple of weeks ago for another public radio station, part of the Classical Music Network, actually. I enjoyed talking to you so much on that occasion.
Well,
I'm going to sneak in a question that I didn't get to ask you that day, which was, what would be your advice to anybody who has the privilege of visiting something that Mr. Olmsted has designed, like the parks of Milwaukee or Chicago? What kinds of things should they look at in order to maybe better appreciate what he did and how his genius is present in some of these beautiful places that at a glance appear to be also largely empty spaces?
I'd say one of the main things is literally to do what comes naturally to you and sort of, you know, walk the ways that you're inclined to walk and look at the things you're inclined to look at, always bearing in mind that this is so very designed. There's so much intent behind it. For instance, Olmsted had this concept known as passages of scenery. And this was an idea that as you're moving through a park, that you're seeing certain things, that you're being guided certain ways. And it was all very subtle. So as you're walking through a park, you know, Olmsted had all kinds of schemes for how he would plant trees and so forth that would affect and create these passages and scenery. And I'll give just one example in Lake Park. Lake Park still subscribes very much to a very classic Olmsted scenery concept, which is you're walking through a ravine in Lake Park, and your view might be blocked. This is a very hallowed Olmsted concept. Your view might be blocked, so you naturally just, you know, you wonder what's on the other side of the view. And furthermore, you feel kind of enclosed. And with Lake Park, all of a sudden there'll be a gap in the trees, very intentional. And in the case of Lake Park, you look through that gap, and you see Lake Michigan in the distance. And so these are very designful things. I mean, creating the sense of sort of suspense and also the sense of enclosure when you wonder what's on the other side, and then all of a sudden a gap where you see something grand in the distance. So I'd say the wonderful thing about an Olmsted park is these are spaces, you know, you don't have to sit down and do a lot of research to understand them. You just, what you're experiencing, I guess the main thing to keep in mind is what you're experiencing is often, though subtle, is actually very skillfully and thoughtfully designed.
Greg, thanks. Thanks for the call. Jane in Janesville, we'll go to you next. Jane, good morning.
Good morning. What a great program. I just wanted to share that people think of New Orleans as Bourbon Street and mm-hmm. the French Quarter and decadency. They don't know often of the treasure that is in New Orleans as well, City Park, which was designed by Frederick Olmsted.
Yeah, you know, I don't know whether I'm not sure whether that was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted or Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. One thing that kind of throws people is Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. very cannily dropped the Jr. from his name. And so it appears that Frederick Law Olmsted Sr. was working from 1858 with Central Park until 1958 when Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. retired and died shortly thereafter. So a lot of parks around the country, and I think this one might fall into that category, were designed by Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. as in the son after dropping the Jr. And I also know that Olmsted didn't do a whole lot. He was very delighted to return to the South and do some work, such as the Biltmore Estate that we talked about earlier in the program in Asheville, North Carolina. But he didn't wind up having he also did a beautiful neighborhood called Druid Hills in Atlanta, but he didn't have a whole lot of landscape work in the South, whereas Frederick Olmsted Jr., I know the Olmsted firm after his death did a lot of stuff throughout the South, so I apologize for not being familiar with that park, but I suspect it was probably a Frederick Olmsted Jr.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. Okay. It is a hidden treasure in New Orleans, though, that has the Olmsted name to it.
Thanks,
great.
Jane.
I've
got two more calls I want to get to here. We're almost out of time, so everybody's going to have to be really brief. Deborah in Brown Deer, you're on next.
Hi. First, I just want to say I grew up in Marquette, and I didn't know the story about Frederick Olmsted. So I grew up eating on Presque Isle, picnicking there every summer. But 10 years ago, I worked with a group of people, and we were trying to save the county grounds here in Milwaukee. And I really feel that having lived in New York City and all over the United States, I feel it really is important to save a chunk of land and as much as possible. So I don't know if you're aware of where the county grounds are here, but you might want to visit. And I think I also lived on 22 Olmsted Road in Scarsdale, New York for a while, and I wondered if Olmsted did any work in Scarsdale, New York, which is in Westchester County.
Yeah, I know Scarsdale. I don't know. In this case with Scarsdale, it could either be that Junior did some work, or it could simply be that Olmsted's name looms so large in New York City that to evoke a kind of rural feel, they might have named the road Olmsted. So I'm not familiar with that specifically. And to your earlier point, I totally agree. I mean, any kind of park in the middle of a city, it's space that was set aside, and it's never to be. The only thing that can be done is to fix it up, because cities have grown up in such a way that that if someone didn't thoughtfully create a park in the middle of a city, it's too late to do it now. So the existing parks are sort of what we're left with, and it's crucial to preserve them.
Well, we're out of time, and probably had another page of questions here. We had callers who we didn't get to. I apologize. A fascinating subject. Perhaps we could return to it again. Thanks for joining me today and for making this fascinating book available to us.
Always my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
The book is Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted, and it was written by Justin Martin. Published by DeCapo Press. Program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, who also handled on-air production. Keep in mind, we'll be back with more Monday and all things political, and then another great hour of programming coming for you on Monday as well. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.